This episode of From Bench to Fireside is a special one for Paisi that marks a network expansion with Weill Cornell Medicine joining as our newest Paisi Center. The partnership will build upon Paisi's work to accelerate research efforts in cancer immunotherapy. Paisi's Chief Scientific Officer, Dr. John Connolly, talks to Dr. Walchuk, who returns to the role of Center Director with this news. Dr. Walchuk dives into his vision for the Paisi Center at Weill Cornell. How does immunity interact with cancer? Better yet, how can cell therapy, cancer vaccines, novel checkpoints, and selective targeting improve? Get ready to go from bench to fireside with Dr. Walchuk as he shares his bold vision for the future of the field.
I'm John Connolly, and I'm here with Dr. Jed Walchuk.
First of all, John, thank you so much for the invitation to chat with you today. And I am indeed really thrilled to be back connected with Paisi as a center director again. And I think it's really exciting to try and put Paisi on the map here at Weill Cornell Medicine. When I think about really what my guiding principles would be in terms of building something here for Paisi, I believe that here at Weill Cornell Medicine, we perform discovery research, and we are involved in the delivery of an outstanding quality of care to people of all walks of life. And so I believe that Paisi at Weill Cornell will continue to perform discovery research now in an enhanced manner with the additional collaboration and resources from the Paisi network to guide the development of new immunotherapeutic approaches that'll be delivered by hopefully a diverse workforce to extremely diverse populations throughout New York City as a window really into what we can do more globally.
It's amazing, Jed. And I think this is something that you've really spearheaded for the entire Paisi network in your time here, is opening up the network for a much, much greater diversity of population. And this is something that is such an important point that people haven't fully really addressed. There's a real problem in access, a problem in diversity, which limits both from the standpoint of problems in giving access to patients that really need it. That's an enormous issue, and I think a primary issue, but also the results are skewed. You've got something where you're really generating results based on very limited patient populations that isn't really pursuant to the kind of science and healthcare change that we're really looking for. So how is it that moving to Cornell really enhances that ability to get access to some of these more diverse populations?
So I think that being at Weill Cornell presents several different opportunities for us to amplify our efforts. The first is that we're now part of a large healthcare system, the New York Presbyterian Hospital System. And so we at Weill Cornell are responsible for cancer care at four hospitals, two in Manhattan, one in Brooklyn, and one in Queens. And we are functioning really as one cancer center, as one faculty, with people traveling between these quite geographically close sites to deliver a high quality of care. Even if most of our laboratory-based discovery research and much of our dry lab research is done on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, that's fine because we can easily export the clinical trials that emanate from that work to all of these different locations. So that's really one advantage. And when we talk about the catchment area that we are being entrusted to serve, we're talking about somewhere in the neighborhood of 6 to 6.5 million people who live in a remarkably small geographic area. I like to equate the fact that our catchment area has about the same number of people as the average US state. And importantly, the people who live in these different areas of New York City, many of them are not currently being treated at a designated cancer center. They are receiving care from a hospital or a private practice that is proximal to their home, which is of course important, but we want to be that healthcare organization that provides high quality, including cutting edge clinical trial based care to people close to their home. It's one of the things we learned in the pandemic was how much could be done in a uncoupled manner from a single site and how important it is for people to be close to home. And I, for one, believe that it's hard enough to live with the abrupt change of all of a sudden having a cancer diagnosis, but then to uproot yourself from your community and your work and have to commute to your cancer care is something that we should try to take off people's minds.
It's enormous and it's a huge burden, but I think that the system that you guys have built there, this really distributed access system out into the community healthcare hospitals and really running those clinical trials, I mean, it really addresses this huge problem in the community, but it also gives you guys access to this diverse patient population.
Absolutely, John. And I just will echo what you said before, that most of what we think that we know about cancer research is derived from blood and tissue from people who look like you and I. As we know, there is so much more to appreciate. And we, I think, will be much better at providing truly precision-guided care when we better understand how a person's ethnic origin, as reflected in their genetic background, plays into the pathogenesis of their cancer and also their therapeutic response.
That's enormous. It's such an untapped area. It's one that I think pharmaceutical companies and academics and everyone need to be rushing into it. But to do that, they need a system like yours. So when you're talking about that advanced care, and we're talking about next generation immunotherapies, you personally have been involved in some of just the most important discoveries that have been out there in the field across multiple modalities of immunotherapy. Where do you see the field going next? Like, where is it that we should be looking out for? And where's the excitement that's in the space right now in your mind?
I think in my mind, but probably top of mind for most of my PiSE colleagues, is cell therapy, right? I think that is the next frontier, and more specifically, cell therapy for common epithelial solid tumors. That is the next frontier that we have to conquer. We've seen the impressive power of cell therapy, of CAR-modified T cells in hematologic malignancies. And now what we need to do is to understand how we can enhance the efficacy and the safety of these approaches in people with solid tumors. Now, some of this is target identification because we have yet to identify the solid tumor equivalent of CD19, right? Or BCMA for that matter. But we also need to continue to work on engineering, safety switches, cargos for CAR T cells, whether we can deploy in vivo CAR T cell manufacturing rather than ex vivo manufacturing. There's a lot of engineering and dry lab and wet lab discovery that needs to be done. And I would be remiss if I didn't mention that some of the other advantages of being at Weill Cornell include living in a large university now, and that large university having a top five school of engineering, which has now a specific program designed to drive engineering advances into medicine. And I think that cellular engineering is likely a big part of that. The other opportunity, which I think that we have, is in the area of a field called comparative oncology, which is basically appreciating that the animals that we choose to live with get cancer and other diseases for many of the same reasons that we do. And as we begin to investigate new approaches for cancer therapy, can we also try to solve this problem in companion animals as well? This is something that I'm a little bit more familiar with than the average person, since I worked on DNA vaccines for dog melanoma now 15, 16 years ago, and saw really the opportunity for doing clinical trials in pet dogs and cats. And of course, Cornell University has really one of the top schools of veterinary medicine in the world, with now a specific canine health program, where one area of interest is in the development of cell therapies for dogs. And I know this is an interest that we share with Penn. And so it's a natural area for collaboration.
The importance here is that it's not a explanted model where you're putting it in sub-Q mouse tumor growth on a an NSG backbone or something like that. This is, they're getting cancer the way you and I do, in time and life naturally, and they're arising. And it's just such an amazing model. Now, what about the tools here? The beauty of this is it's a great model and you have accessibility and you're actually solving some problems. You're potentially curing some family members, some pets. It'd be great. But what about the models for analysis and all the tools that we have in the dog space? I just don't know where we're at right now in that.
So they are better than they were when I first tiptoed into this area 15 or so years ago, where the number of anti-dog immune marker antibodies was quite limited. That's come along quite a ways, as has the concept of the caninized antibody. So now some of the first caninized, like PD-1 blocking antibodies, are becoming more widely known. I'm not as up to date on drug approvals in the canine space, but I think that it took a while, but I think now more is being learned about antibodies as drugs in the canine species as well.
And I love it. The other reason is as you naturally develop some of these solid tumors, they're already selected by the dog immune system. They've gone through the same kind of evolution that perhaps the tumors in humans go through. So this is something I'd love to see us as a network begin to pull together at our Pisces centers, talk to people that are really interested in it, and then maybe reach out to partners that can get great access to wonderful veterinary schools like yours at Cornell.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's really great. And then whatever we can do to try to link up with tools to do the analysis.
Yes.
It's spectacular. So in the cell therapy space, I think the solid tumors area is something that we've all been striving to. And I think that the advances that we've made both in the incredible labs throughout the Pisces network and really around the world in improving efficacy have just started to see a little sign. Some wonderful responses in the GD2 CAR space, there's some other targets that we're starting to see some responses in. But one of the things we're getting is toxicity associated with these. And I think qualitatively, the toxicity looks a little bit different. So how are we going to be approaching these toxicity issues and really addressing them when it's not something that we're able to model in the mice very well? Maybe we can do it in dogs. But where do you see this at this point? And what are the technology that you're bringing to the table to address it?
Yeah, I think that the toxicity is obviously front of mind, and it drives us either toward or away from different targets for these engineered cell populations. And so the lowest hanging fruit that we're going after right now, just as proof of principle to learn some basic lessons about cell therapy and solid tumors, is using a anti-TRP1 antibody-armed CAR for melanoma, recognizing that the pigmentation-associated antigens are present on normal melanocytes, and so we will expect some hypopigmentation. There is justifiable concern around eye toxicity, but in the mouse models, as well as with an antibody against this same target that I led a phase 1 trial for a few years ago, we did not see any ocular toxicity. So it may be that the eye is protected from this. But I think that being able to turn off these cell populations if they should create any unwanted damage to normal tissue is a critical part of the engineering that we bring forward. And that's really one of our most important considerations, as is collaborating really with some of the phenomenal colleagues in the genomic space, as well as in other computational areas, to help us select some targets with even greater accuracy.
Absolutely. I think it's great. What are your thoughts on the synthetic biology of barcoding and gates and things like that? I think, is that sort of where these are going to lead, or is this really something that maybe just works for a certain subset of tumors?
I think it's where we need to go. I've thoroughly enjoyed the discussions of this kind of, I would say, next generation cellular engineering that I've attended at the Pisces retreats, right? So folks like Alex Marson and Cole Roybal, right? These are world leaders, right, in this area of how do you design the optimal engineered immune cell population. And I think, especially as we think about the shared nature of many of the targets, this is going to be critical. The truth is, even CD20, it just so happens that as human beings, we can live okay lives without having B cells, yeah, right? But that kind of trade-off has not yet become evident for solid tumor targets.
Do you think that also reflects the heterogeneity in the development of the immunoselection, the solid tumors itself, relative to lymphomas and stuff.
Yes.
That's tough. So maybe you do need barcodes. Maybe there is a barcode for a particular set of tumors in which you've got maybe three targets that have to be co-expressed. Two of three have to be expressed. And we've just got to get in there and dive deep into that decoding. And maybe that's great. And so one thing you did mention before in the dog space is the vaccine work. So it's another area that we've seen a lot at the Pisces retreats and out there actually in publications is a rise again in these cancer vaccines. And so a lot of this has to do with vaccine, accelerated vaccine development during COVID. But we also have that has really shown itself to be a proof of concept in terms of technology. We can build a lot of these vaccines. So where do you see the direction of the vaccine space and how do you feel this integrates within other immunotherapies?
First of all, I am amazed by how far we've come in terms of the concept and the feasibility of personalized cancer vaccines. I could not imagine 15 years ago being able to produce this kind of a product in the time frame that now is fully realized. If we look at Vinod Balachandran's pancreatic cancer trial, that just showed you what is possible. With modern approaches to vaccine preparation, really accelerated developments in next generation sequencing that can be done quickly and at a reasonable financial scale. This is frankly amazing. PICE, more than most organizations, also realizes one of the remaining challenges, which is the selection of the most optimal epitopes. That the Tesla project that was spearheaded by PICE showed us that even with some of the brightest minds working on the best algorithms for epitope selection, we're still not particularly good at it. or we can't agree who's good at it. Let's leave it at that. But we'll get there with more interactions and more knowledge and computational efforts. The other thing that's different now in terms of cancer vaccines is our ability to rationally combine them with other means of immune modulation. In the early days of peptide vaccines back in the day, we had adjuvants, but those adjuvants were things like subcutaneous GM-CSF injections or Montanide, Freund's adjuvant, things of that nature. But now we have the ability to give a dose of anti-CTLA-4 with a vaccine, right? Or we have the ability to recruit dendritic cells to the site of vaccination with FLT3 ligand. This is work of PICE extramural member researcher Nina Bardwaj, right? So just we have a different toolbox with which to think about vaccination now.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. And I was speaking with Nina not that long ago at the retreat. It's such an incredible advance that we have. When you think about the immune system relative to, say, other cancer therapies, there's an opportunity to really create foundational work with things like vaccines and then build upon that with other types of checkpoints. And as you talked about, rationally designed adjuvants, it's absolutely amazing. And then one other area that we're seeing a lot of, I think, is this concept of novel checkpoints. That's an area where we had a big, massive burst with things like PD-1, CTLA-4, LAG-3, I think is another. How are you seeing that field developing? It's been a tougher struggle, I think, but I think, are we turning the corner now with any recent data?
I don't think we've turned the corner in a big enough way yet. We've had some success with LAG-3 being added to the list, but it's hard to stray from the initial observation that CTLA-4 and PD-1 are the foundational checkpoints.
Right.
Some of that knowledge shouldn't be surprising if we think back to the knockout mice for CTLA-4 that were generated by Arlene Sharp and TACMAC, where those mice were not compatible with life, right? They died at an early age of fulminant lymphocytic infiltration. So the fact that's a non-redundant checkpoint that's important knowledge. I'm more optimistic about our ability to resurrect the immune agonist pathways, the co-stimulatory pathways, CD137, OX40, GITR, others, because those were investigated and then pretty much uniformly abandoned. Without a great degree of attention paid to whether or not the drugs were hitting their immunologic targets. It was clear that they were not making tumors go away in people who had cancer that was resistant to checkpoint blockade, because that was largely the population of patients who volunteered for those clinical trials. But what we've learned in the past few years, again, in mouse models and in some cases in humans as well, is that some of these agonist pathways are best thought of as being employed in the context of other forms of anti-cancer therapy, right? So the OX40 agonist that we've been working on for a while now, turns out that it can enable bystander killing after an infusion of antigen-specific T cells that overcomes heterogeneous antigen expression via neutrophils, believe it or not. And that would not be the first clinical trial that any investigator would consider doing with a new immunotherapy. But now maybe that's the context that we need to think about, that we've got freezers full of these medicines, yeah, right, that are not being used, but might be able to be repurposed in very specific combination strategies that were not part of the original clinical development plan.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's because really the foundational research that you and others have done in this space, it holds up. And so it's all the biology's there. It's about finding the right clinical trial and clinical trial design,
yep,
that can fit that patient population. So one of the things that we see this in the ADC space, the recent ESMO data of acquisitions, a lot of activity in the space, but it's also in the context of cytokine delivery and selective cytokine and targeted delivery. Do you think that there's an opportunity now for this kind of selective agonist where we're delivering OX40 stimulation specifically to precursor exhausted cells or specifically to certain cell populations in terms of biologics engineering?
Yes, I think that the latest generation of these engineered cytokines are really exciting. Obviously, the work of another Pisces colleague, Chris Garcia, has really taken this to the next level, I think. And I have a lot of interest in following those clinical trials moving forward. But how do you then use that kind of technology in terms of T-cell engineering?
Yeah, absolutely. It makes a ton of sense. And so one of the other areas I think that we've seen, at least in the cell therapy space, is trying to address problems associated with first generation therapies, which was a lot of persistence issues that were there. How are you feeling really about the novel approaches that people have, either the PiSE network, even outside the PiSE network, to improve long-term persistence of some of these cell therapies for cancer?
I think that PiSE took one of the first steps forward with the work of Carl June, right? Trying to genetically alter the CAR T cells to lack PD-1, right? And so I think that persistence is important. I would say it's as important as making sure that you can get rid of the function of these cells if you should run into toxicity trouble. But no, I think that this is a very important area for us. And also, when we think about the financial toxicity as well of some of these things, not having to give treatments like this more than once, if you can hold on to persistence, or if you could give a smaller dose and get it produced more quickly, for example, yeah, those are advantages.
And then you mentioned originally the kind of in vivo CAR delivery. Where are we there now in that space? And how do you feel about technology development there and addressing cost issues? That could be amazing.
That could be really a logarithmic step forward. I think we're still in very early days with this. So I'm eager to see that move along as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's something that could truly, absolutely be a game changer. I know you mentioned Carl, part of the work there. It's fun that the work that the Penn team is focused on in terms of improving manufacturing, it turns out this has really improved a lot of capability too, capacity of those cells to kill. You know, it turns out the shorter that you have for in vitro culture, the more stem-like characteristics and the better quality those cells actually come out. So this is something that even if we're not quite there yet on in vivo delivery, just the advances we have in shortening the time has really improved the process overall.
Absolutely. I remember hearing about some of Carl's early work in this area one or two retreats ago, and it's really exciting.
Oh, it's something that I'm really excited about. And that's another part too, is shortening this process gives us another area of access, right? So if we can miniaturize this process, shorten it, get it a little more bedside focused, try to strive toward that 24-hour manufacturing process for everybody. This is something that should improve both quality and obviously deliver the ability to actually deliver it to patients.
Yeah, accessibility.
Absolutely, accessibility. So Jed, in terms of the center itself, you're kicking it off. You're building out this incredible center at BICI. You've always been known for developing the next generation of physician scientists. For me, this has been just an enormous value to the network, but also most importantly to all of us in the community. What are your plans now at Weill Cornell to develop these clinician scientists to have that view from the bench side, from the bench right into the clinic?
Yeah, I think that's one of the great opportunities the PICI affords us, is to pay attention to this very vulnerable and rare population of scientists and physician scientists that need funding to bridge them through some of these early days as senior postdocs going into the early years of their faculty appointment. And PICI has wisely targeted those folks for some of their PICI intramural grants. I have had the absolute privilege of mentoring some of those folks, and it's just wonderful to see their careers take off. I'm actually very fond of saying that I followed Roberta Zappasotti, who came to Weill Cornell a year before Taha and I did. And it's really great to see this next generation emerge and importantly be supported. We all know that academic science is very difficult, that the funding climate is challenging. And so the more that we can bring to these young folks to have them attracted to this as their dream career and to keep them here, the better off we'll be for the future. Our legacies are really written by our mentees, right? And I think the better off we can make their working conditions, the better off we all will be. I think it's a real privilege to be at a medical school as well as a graduate school. I see lots of very eager, talented medical students, lots of interns, residents, as well as oncology fellows, graduate students. So it's a very vibrant academic environment. And if we can help to interest some of these super smart young people in the area of immuno-oncology, then we win.
Absolutely. And the other aspect of this, we want to continue to support them too. The fellows that we're supporting early on, we want to continue to really support them all the way through. And they're so incredibly productive and so amazingly driven. We want to keep them in the network too. So we'd love to have them be the next generation of full-on PICI investigators. Jed, I just want to thank you so much. We're so excited to work with you and to continue to work with you at PICI and to work with you closely to as you build out this completely new center there at Weill Cornell. It's going to be just such an amazing, exciting time. And you and Taha are just such great center directors that we know there are great things to come. So I just want to thank you for the time now and thank you so much for being a part of the network.
Thanks goes back to you and all the PICI colleagues, John. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to From Bench to Fireside, and special thanks to this season's PICI Network contributors from Dana-Farber, UCSF, Stanford Medicine, Mount Sinai, UCLA, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, and Weill Cornell Medicine. To donate to support PICI's mission, please visit parkerici.org/donate. You can find From Bench to Fireside on Spotify. To be notified of new episodes, like or subscribe to our channel. For the latest at the Parker Institute for Cancer Immunotherapy, follow us on X and LinkedIn at ParkerICI or visit www.parkerici.org to learn how we aim to accelerate the development of breakthrough immune therapies to turn all cancers into curable diseases. From Bench to Fireside is produced by the Parker Institute for Cancer Immunotherapy. All content and opinions expressed in this podcast belong solely to the Parker Institute. From Bench to Fireside is a trademark of the Parker Institute for Cancer Immunotherapy. We'll see you next time as Parker Network experts in immunotherapy take you from behind the lab bench to the frontiers of cancer research.